He glanced at the ice wrapped around her ankle.
Can we keep it quiet? I should be able to move around soon, don't you think?
We can try to keep it quiet, but Luigi has a way of knowing things. He follows me closely. I'll call in sick tomorrow, then we'll figure out something the next day. Maybe we could study here.
No, my husband is here.
Marco couldn't help but glance over his shoulder. Here?
He's in the bedroom, very ill.
What's
cancer? The last stages. My mother sits with him when I'm working. The hospice nurse comes in each afternoon to medicate him.
I'm sorry.
So am I.
Don't worry about Luigi. I'll tell him that I'm thrilled with your teaching style and that I will refuse to work with anyone else.
That would be a lie, wouldn't it?
Sort of. Signora Altinelli was back with a tray of torta and espresso. She placed it on a bright red coffee table in the middle of the room and began slicing. Francesca took the coffee but didn't feel like eating. Marco ate as slowly as humanly possible and sipped from his small cup as if it might be his last. When Signora Altinelli insisted on another slice and a refill, he grudgingly accepted. Marco stayed about an hour. Riding down in the elevator, he realized that Giovanni Ferro had not made a sound. Chapter 23. Red China's principal intelligence agency, the Ministry of State Security, or MSS, used small, highly trained units to carry out assassinations around the world in much the same manner as the Russians, Israelis, British, and Americans. One notable difference, though, was that the Chinese had come to rely upon one unit in particular. Instead of spreading the dirty work around like other countries, the MSS turned first to a young man the CIA and Mossad had been watching with great admiration for several years. His name was Sammy Tin, the product of two red Chinese diplomats who were rumored to have been selected by the MSS to marry and reproduce. If ever an agent were perfectly cloned, it was Sammy Tin. Born in New York City and raised in the suburbs around D.C., he had been educated by private tutors who bombarded him with foreign languages from the time he left diapers. He entered the University of Maryland at the age of 16. Left it with 2 degrees at the age of 21, then studied engineering in Hamburg, Germany. Somewhere along the way, he picked up bomb-making as a hobby. Explosives became his passion, with an emphasis on controlled explosions from odd packages, envelopes, paper cups, ballpoint pens, cigarette packages. He was an expert marksman, but guns were simple and bored him. The Tin Man loved his bombs. He then studied chemistry under an assumed name in Tokyo, and there he mastered the art and science of killing with poisons. By the time he was 24, he had a dozen different names, about that many languages, and crossed borders with a vast array of passports and disguises. He could convince any customs agent anywhere that he was Japanese, Korean, or Taiwanese. To round out his education, he spent a grueling year in training with an elite Chinese army unit. He learned to camp, cook over a fire, cross raging rivers, survive in the ocean, and live in the wilderness for days. When he was 26, the MSS decided the boy had studied enough. It was time to start killing. As far as Langley could tell, he began notching his astounding body count with the murders of 3 red Chinese scientists who had gotten too cozy with the Russians. He got them over dinner at a restaurant in Moscow. While their bodyguards waited outside, one got his throat slit in the men's room while he finished up at the urinal. It took an hour to find his body, crammed in a rather small garbage can. The second made the mistake of worrying about the first. He went to the men's room where the Tin Man was waiting, dressed as a janitor. They found him with his head stuffed down the toilet, which had been clogged and was backing up. The third died seconds later at the table, where he was sitting alone and becoming very worried about his 2 missing colleagues. A man in a waiter's jacket hurried by and, without slowing, thrust a poisoned dart into the back of his neck. As killings go, It was all quite sloppy. Too much blood, too many witnesses. Escape was dicey, but the tin man got a break and managed to dash through the busy kitchen unnoticed. He was on the loose and sprinting through a back alley by the time the bodyguards were summoned. He ducked into the dark city, caught a cab, and 20 minutes later entered the Chinese embassy. The next day he was in Beijing, quietly celebrating his first success. The audacity of the attack shocked the intelligence world. Rival agencies scrambled to find out who did it. It ran so contrary to how the Chinese normally eliminated their enemies. They were famous for their patience, the discipline to wait and wait until the timing was perfect. They would chase until their prey simply gave up, or they would ditch one plan and go to the next, carefully waiting for their opportunity. When it happened again a few months later in Berlin, the Tin Man's legend was born. A French executive had handed over some bogus high-tech secrets dealing with mobile radar. He got flung from the balcony of a 14th-floor hotel room, and when he landed beside the pool, it upset quite a few sunbathers. Again, the killing was much too visible. In London, the Tin Man blew a man's head off with a cell phone. A defector in New York's Chinatown lost most of his face when a cigarette exploded. Sammy Tin was soon getting credit for most of the more dramatic intelligence killings in that underworld. The legend grew rapidly. Though he kept 4 or 5 trusted members in his unit, he often worked alone. He lost a man in Singapore when their target suddenly emerged with some friends, all with guns. It was a rare failure, and the lesson from it was to stay lean, strike fast, and don't keep too many people on the payroll. As he matured, the hits became less dramatic, less violent, and much easier to conceal. He was now 33 and without a doubt the most feared agent in the world. The CIA spent a fortune trying to track his movements. They knew he was in Beijing, hanging around his luxurious apartment. When he left, they tracked him to Hong Kong. Interpol was alerted when he boarded a non-stop flight to London, where he changed passports and at the last moment boarded an Alitalia flight to Milan. Interpol could only watch. Sammy Tin often traveled with diplomatic cover. He was no criminal. He was an agent, a diplomat, a businessman, a professor, anything he needed to be. A car was waiting for him at Milan's Malpensa Airport, and he vanished into the city. As far as the CIA could tell, it had been 4.5 years since the Tin Man had set foot in Italy. Mr. Ilya certainly looked the part of a wealthy Saudi businessman, though his heavy wool suit was almost black, a little too dark for Bologna, and its pinstripes were much too thick for anything designed in Italy. And his shirt was pink, with a glistening white collar. Not a bad combo, but, well, it was still pink. Through the collar was a gold bar, also too thick, that pushed the knot of the tie up tightly for the choking look, and at each end of the bar was a diamond. Mr. Ilya was into diamonds. A large one on each hand, dozens of smaller ones clustered in his Rolex, a couple more in the gold cuffs of his shirt. The shoes appeared to Stefano to be Italian, brand new, brown, but much too light to go with the suit. As a whole, the package simply wasn't working. It was trying mightily, though. Stefano had time to analyze his client while they rode in virtual silence from the airport, where Mr. Ilya and his assistant had arrived by private jet to the center of Bologna. They were in the rear of a black Mercedes, one of Mr. Ilya's conditions, with a driver who was silent in the front seat along with the assistant, who evidently spoke only Arabic. Mr. Ilya's English was passable, quick bursts of it, usually followed with something in Arabic to the assistant, who felt compelled to write down everything his master said. After 10 minutes in the car with them, Stefano was already hoping they would finish well before lunch. The first apartment he showed them was near the university, where Mr. Ilya's son would soon arrive to study medicine. 4 rooms on the second floor, no elevator,